This is Desiree Scales, and welcome to the High Velocity Show on Business Radio X. I've got Kevin Finn here with me today. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. How you doing, Desiree? It's always glad. I love having you in the studio. You're a pro by now.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, I guess they thought I was a real pro because they gave me my own show here.
I know. That doesn't normally happen, believe it or not.
Really? So. Well, there you go. Here we are.
So did you have a good Labor Day?
Yeah, I did. What about you?
I had a great Labor Day. I went to Birmingham to visit my girlfriend's parents and just relaxed and drank beer and did nothing. Watched football. It was awesome.
Wow. Well, I was in front of the computer a lot over the weekend because I was getting a certification for some software. But, you know, it was actually fun. I enjoy being in front of the computer.
So. I do, too. I was in front of the computer, too, the whole weekend while I was watching football. So I'm working on my AdWords certification, so
yeah,
I know the feeling.
Good for you. So you know.
Definitely. Well, you have some great guests in the studio today, don't you?
Yes, we're very, very excited for the inaugural, you know, Desiree Scales High Velocity Show. We've got a couple really interesting guests. We've got Sander Bean from AT&T, and Sander and I met at Product Camp a few weeks back, and he was talking about Einstein. And that prompted me to think about Sarah Miller Caldicott. And she is the author of Midnight Lunch, and she's the great-grandniece of Thomas Alva Edison. And I thought, I've got to get these two minds together,
awesome.
You know, behind these great inventors and, you know, these two men who completely changed history and how we live today with innovation. And that's really what I want to touch on in this show. I want to talk about innovation and collaboration because, you know, that's what Sarah and Sander talk best about, innovation and collaboration. So Sarah is calling in today from my hometown of Chicago. How are you doing, Sarah?
Doing great, thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you for sharing your time with us today. And, you know, wanted to include you in, it's not midnight, and it's past lunchtime, but, you know, it's okay. We're still going to collaborate on the show and talk about, you know, teamwork, collaboration. And, you know, that's reading your book, that is a statement that you make, that there is a big difference between teamwork and collaboration. Can we talk about that? What's the difference?
Sure. Well, this is one of the things that we commonly mistake one for the other. Teamwork is really about doing your part, kind of putting in your time, contributing what is expected of you. And teamwork is certainly a very important part of what we do today in the business world. So this is really not to, you know, cast any judgments or ill conceptions about teamwork at all. But when we think about collaboration, we actually go beyond teamwork to a point where there is a learning continuum. It's not really a task focus that happens in collaboration. People are willing to dedicate their time and actually prepare their minds for the journey of collaboration. Typically, collaboration takes place over time, and it is part of expanding the capabilities of the people who are on the collaboration team and actually ensuring that everybody learns over the course of the collaborative effort. So those are a couple of differences between teamwork and collaboration.
That's perfect. You know, and you gave a great example of the three-legged race and a couple of different teams in the book and, you know, how they work together differently, where one team, you know, nobody's doing much, they're getting the job done, but the other team, they really have to think and work together because of their different various, you know, differences.
Sure.
I love that.
Exactly. Well, a three-legged race, and I don't know if you've ever had a chance to run one.
I have.
But I know.
Yes.
I have a couple of times, and certainly a three-legged race is not the easiest way to cover territory.
Right.
But what is true is that you go through a process of thinking strategically. You go through a process of experimenting. Certainly there's a lot of trial and error in the process. But what's really fantastic about running a three-legged race is that you could actually teach others how to do it effectively when you're done. It isn't just a one-off learning experience. You actually can spread what you learn to others, and that's one of the differences, I think, also between teamwork and collaboration, the ability to pass your knowledge along and actually expand the capabilities of others.
So, Sarah, let me ask you this. What actually prompted you to examine Thomas Edison's innovation methods?
Well, you know, I think innovation today is such a central part of what makes businesses successful in the global economy. We have so much digital activity that we're all engaged in, whether it's smartphones or laptops, virtual networks that we're part of. This is really transforming how innovation takes place today and also the speed with which it takes place. So having a more thorough understanding of what innovation entails, I thought was really important to just bring out. Looking at Edison's successes certainly gives us a great starting point for understanding what innovation is and how we can all learn from his activity and his procedures and methods. So that was a big reason for getting started with that.
Well, you know, excuse me, in the book you also talked about how you could be innovative as a small business, or you can be innovative within a large enterprise, like AT&T, Sander. You know, and Sander, you are an Einstein expert and studied his ways. And the thing about Einstein is he worked at the patent office. You know, I was at your talk at Product Camp, and you talked about how even though he was at the patent office, he came up with his theory of relativity, and he worked within a large organization, but he was allowed to be innovative. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so Einstein's an interesting case. And the part that really talked to me, you know, working all my life inside of a large organization like AT&T, is that it was from that place and not from a university hall that he uncovered the theory of relativity. And he did this in such a way that it was sort of drawn from the things that he was looking at in the patent office, which at the time was electromagnetic devices that basically were helping train traffic that was going crisscrossing the United States and other places.
Wow.
It was amazing that, you know, he took something that's what we would consider very low tech today and came up with probably the most high tech of ideas that you're ever going to think about.
Right, right. Now, how did you get interested in Einstein and his, you know, innovation and his spirit of innovation, basically?
Right. So you mentioned before, sometimes it can be daunting or very difficult to feel like you can innovate from a place as large as, like, say, an AT&T, where everybody has just a piece part to play in what they're doing in large organizations. And what was astounding to me is that Einstein was in the exact same situation. The other thing that was interesting to me is that full 70% of us feel disengaged from the jobs that we're in today.
Right.
And this is from a Gallup poll from, I believe, 2012. And that people feel like, if only I could be in the right job. Well, can you think of anybody in the more wrong job than Albert Einstein working at a patent office?
Right.
And
a lot of people forget that.
And yeah. It was from there that he took off from a platform. So I started asking myself, like, what were some of the principles? What were some of the things that he did that were different that enabled him to innovate in such a way from that type of a job? And it's exactly what Sarah was saying. While he didn't always do things the easy way, every day he looked at different ways of approaching the problems and the things that he was looking at, kind of going back to that analogy of the three-legged race.
Right, exactly. So, you know, you're in sales right now for AT&T, and how did you start getting curious about innovation and innovating within your organization? Because you have done some really innovative stuff with social media and social selling. Tell us about that.
Well, thanks, yes. But I have to tell you that I started out with the first 16 years of just kind of doing what I was told and doing things the same old normal way inside the sales organization. But I took a job here in Atlanta working with a customer. And my customer, our relationship could have been better. We were viewed as a supplier. We weren't exactly being asked to bid on the most interesting and new solution type sales there. And I started saying to myself, how can we get in front of the people with the budgets, the people that we want to talk to? The 16 years of my experience were telling me, oh, you just need to keep cold calling. You just need to invite them to the right golf course.
Yeah.
If we take them to the right trattoria in Buckhead, we will have their engagement. But there was another part of me that was very interested in social media, and it was something I wanted to try. And I had been trying to get into sort of a more marketing role, but wasn't finding a way to do it. And so from the platform of the role that I was in sales, mm-hmm. I decided to launch into this social media mm-hmm. and make this innovative leap. And it sort of all clicked with me at that point. And the more I read about Einstein, the more I didn't liken myself to Einstein, but the more I realized that I had taken sort of that innovative leap. And, yeah. and reading Sarah's book, I felt a lot more of that juice coming back on that.
Okay. Right, right.
Well, how would a middle management person, these large companies, they're trying to streamline everything. They have their systems in place. You follow A, B, and C. How does someone break out of that and get their ideas to the top so they can innovate? Because middle management, they're dealing with the main people all day, and they definitely have some good ideas.
Absolutely. What Einstein did was there were really three things that I noticed that he did. But one of them was that he basically just morphed his job into the job that he wanted to have.
Right.
So he was a theoretical physicist working in a patent office. And what he needed to do to get himself to where he wanted to go was he needed to stay after the dreams that he had, stay after what it was that he found to be important and interesting. And he had to spend a lot of time doing it. So inside of an organization like this, if you want to innovate, you need to be spending that additional time, the after hours, et cetera. I also believe that companies can meet you halfway, and that's something that Sarah talks about in her book as well.
Yeah, great segue back to Sarah. So, Sarah, you know, tell us, why do you think it's important for organizations and teams to really understand collaboration, especially in this day and age of the innovation age?
Well, I think there are a couple reasons. One of the first ones is speed and the speed with which markets are changing. We can read in the business press about, innovators that have not kept pace with their competitors or with shifts in the marketplace. RIM, the makers of the BlackBerry, mm-hmm. Kodak, JCPenney, which hasn't been a super fast, force in the world of retailing, but we can look at Target as having changed a lot of the dynamics in the world of retailing. And if we don't if these organizations don't have an internal culture that encourages collaborative activity, they're going to lag behind. So collaboration is very important to stay innovative. Just thinking about some of the things Sander was just saying, the notion of working inside a large organization and not really knowing where to start is something that we all face if we are part of a large company. And certainly Edison faced this as well. He worked for Western Union for a number of years, which
right.
was one of the top five largest companies in the United States in his time. And part of what we can do today, as Edison did in his time, is to look at needs. What are the customer needs? What are the marketplace needs that are out there that, we have ideas to solve? And that can really help gain management's attention. This is part of how you can cut through some of the clutter, cut through some of the procedures and the red tape that can exist in large companies. Really start looking at needs and how to fulfill needs in a new way. So this is a great starting point for people who do have this dream, this idea, this concept they want to bring forward. I would also add that part of what was successful in Edison's labs and also part of what we see as being a powerful force today is microcultures. There are certain parts of companies that can be more innovative than others. So if you can find some of the folks that work in those areas that you perceive to be a little bit more proactive, a little bit more forward-leaning, that is to your benefit. If we look at Microsoft, for example, which is not a company that has typically been known for being innovative, there's obviously a lot been written in the last several days about Steve Ballmer and some of the mm-hmm. missteps mm-hmm. that he's taken at Microsoft. Microcultures actually generated the Kinect game system that has been so successful for Microsoft and the Xbox, its predecessor as well. These were pods and groups of people within the organization that collaborated, had ideas on ways to meet needs that customers had, and they actually developed prototypes and brought some of their ideas to management's attention with actual physical stuff to show. So Absolutely. You can put a proposal together, put a PowerPoint together, put documents together, but sometimes you can actually put a physical prototype together as well. That was one of the things that Edison excelled at doing,
right,
was to actually
right.
make something to show someone. Mm-hmm. So those are two thoughts on ways to cut through some of the challenges that we face in large organizations and help things move a little faster.
Gotcha. So what's interesting, Sandra, I sent you this article the other day about Google. You know, they gave their employees a certain amount of time for innovation, and now they've cut it back. I don't know if you've seen that.
Mm-hmm.
You want to speak on that?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, and it comes in the wake of other things that are happening, like the Marissa Mayer cutting back on people working from home. It's sort of like a counterculture. And I think you're often going to see this, that there's going to be a backlash against something that seems like it's moving us forward. And it's really a way of actually propelling us. Because I believe what happens is it pulls back in, and it's sort of like a wave. And then it comes up even higher and pulls further up onto the beach.
Yeah.
But I just think that, you know, one of the things that Sarah talked about in the in her book was, you know, the changing, going from an industrial age to an age of information.
Right.
And I think that that's really the tipping point that we're at. We still have a lot of command and control. And I think that's what you're seeing at some of these companies, where there's a backlash now, because there's still a whole methodology that the top makes decisions and the bottom kind of does. The top thinks and the bottom does.
Right.
But really, I think we're moving into a much different environment. I heard an executive at a company talking recently and saying, boy, you know, we have to make sure that our executives here are not on social media. We don't want them on social media. And, you know, I thought it was interesting because I asked why, and they said, well, you know, they're liable to make a mistake. They might have the wrong kind of interaction with somebody. And I said, you know, isn't it kind of like being able to view a more diverse group of ideas? It's sort of a flattening, if you will, so that more diverse ideas from all around the organization and outside the organization, for that matter, can reach those executives. And that's been, for me, a secret of success in my sales life, but also a secret of success as I move forward from an executive perspective, too, and decide what it is I want to do next in the areas that I'm interested in looking at. And I think it fits in nicely with this notion of collaboration. I mean, social media is really just opening yourself up to a much more diverse group of ideas than just a group of people that might even report to you.
Right. And Sarah, you talk about flat teams in your book.
Yes. And Sandra, I think this is a great point. The notion of, you know, command and control versus a type of mechanism that yields decision-making in a flatter culture. I think that Marissa Mayer is kind of, you know, coming right up against that at this point. But the flat team is one that Edison really favored. He liked to use small teams for his collaborations, you know, teams of not more than eight people. And right there, we can see a challenge with many organizations today. A lot of times, teams start at like 12, 15, sometimes even 20 people. And so you begin with this force that's somewhat unwieldy to manage, and the communication within that team gets very, very difficult. So the small team was something that Edison really liked to use in this flat structure. A second characteristic that I would note is these teams were diverse. They had people who were experts in certain areas and also people who were more generalists, who didn't have a particular area of expertise. And Edison often included people who were new to his organization on collaborations. I mentioned before that collaboration is kind of a learning process. So he wanted this sense of discovery and learning to engage younger people in the organization and not just people who had been there for, say, 10 years, 8 years, what have you. So flat teams had a really unique quality to them in Edison's world. So, you know, if we look at Amazon, this is something that Jeff Bezos has really taken on board, these diverse small teams. He calls them actually two pizza teams. If it takes more than two pizzas to
like
feed
that.
The team, then you have too many folks on that team. So I think Marissa is doing some good things at Google. At Yahoo. I think that, you know, she's learning. Some of the challenge I think she has is, you know, what is that strategic vision for the organization? And that's really where I think she's had to kind of shift some of the work culture to kind of realign how people are collaborating, to realign what it is that they're focused on and that they're working on for the bulk of their work hours. So it's a tough thing. I think we can look at it as kind of a backlash. I actually look at it as Marissa trying to create alignment.
Yeah.
Because without a collaborative sense within an organization, without a sense of collegiality, you really can't generate that kind of alignment. So it's been controversial, and I think we'll probably see more controversy before we see less.
Yeah.
But a lot of challenges exist around the notion of flat teams and how to manage them.
And the thing I was looking at is the other end of the spectrum here. So it's interesting to hear the end of the spectrum around from the executive point of view. But from the point of view of the workers themselves, this is something that I think Einstein showed when he was in that patent office, is he wasn't going to let go of his dreams. Despite the fact that he couldn't find, and the reason he was working the patent office to begin with, and I don't know if I mentioned this, but the reason he was working there to begin with was because he could not find a job. He got out of the university with his advanced degrees in physics, and you know, let's try to imagine Albert Einstein looking for a university job. But
sounds familiar. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, apparently, you know, we go through these cycles every now and again where university jobs are not to be found.
Right.
But going into the job at the patent office, he wasn't going to let go of what he was interested in. He was doing this purely for himself, and I believe that this is something you're seeing, especially now with the Gen Y or the generation as it comes in to the workplace.
Right.
They are very much about who they are, and they want to do their best. They want to be collaborating. They want to be bringing something to the table.
Yeah.
They want to be learning. They want to be creating, and they want to be making the world a better place. It's important, and I think all of us as humans, if we're not doing that, we're really not. We're doing a disservice to ourselves. Really, I think we're doing a disservice to our companies and our employers.
So, Sander, you know, the stories of Einstein and Edison, where do you think that they intersect, and you know, what do you think they offer corporate America or even business owners, small business owners? What?
You know, I've thought about this a lot, Sarah and Desiree, because, you know, having just read your book recently here, and I was saying, where do these intersect? Because we have this notion of collaboration, but right. Einstein was, at least the part that I talk about him and the part that I'm interested in, he was sort of on his own, being his own person. We don't know to what extent he was collaborating in that patent office. Who
right.
knows? Maybe there's
right.
a generalist patent clerk who really should be a byline in the theory of relativity. I guess we will never know. It sounds like a good movie, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
but what I appreciated about Sarah's book was just the notion of freeing your minds and not feeling that, you know, looking for something that is going to improve the world. So it's more of a mission than it's just how we got to get this done.
Right.
And also just freeing your mind on how it could get done. And I don't want to steal any of Sarah's thunder, but I mean that the notion of how many different types of materials that Edison looked at for filament
right.
and combinations of materials for filament inside of the incandescent light bulb.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was astounding. It was just a moment of like saying, well, it doesn't have to just be a metal wire. It could be almost anything, even a horse hair or
right.
people's hair.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing when you think about that. And Sandra, I think your points are right on. Part of where I see some connection between Edison and Einstein is that they started looking at context. They weren't necessarily trying to go, you know, hell-bent for a specific answer, kind of in a black and white sense. Like, let's get the numbers here, or let's get the data, and let's look at all the data and try to make a decision. You know, data can be really helpful in making decisions, but I think both Edison and Einstein were looking for patterns. And when we look at things in the context of patterns, we actually see different relationships. And that's where you can start to create richness and new thinking, new perspectives around, you know, the problem that you're aiming to solve. A second thing that you talked about was the sense of purpose or mission. And that's actually hugely important in collaboration. People need to feel a reason why they're connected. They need to feel some kind of common purpose that's going to bind them together so that when you're in a collaboration and you're working for weeks and months, you can revisit and go, okay, now why are we doing this again?
Yep.
You've got to be able to come back to that central reason or reasons that generate that purpose, that generate that meaning for you. So it's really important to keep that kind of in front of a team at all times.
You know, and that's funny you say that, because the Gen Y, you know, and Gen X, I mean, they want to make a difference in the world. That is their main purpose. And, you know, they want to be able to do that within corporations, and then they want to be able to leave and start their own startups. And you're right, they have to, everybody needs to be on the same page and have the same vision. But what causes teams to fall apart, Sarah?
Well, you know, there are a couple of things. One that I found most extraordinary as I was doing my research for Midnight Lunch was different definitions for progress. So right there, we can feel almost like the vibe around that. Sometimes management, to them, progress is doing things within a specific amount of time. It can be a week, it can be 90 days, it can be 10 days. You know, progress is measured by revenue, or progress is measured by, you know, market penetration. It can be, you know, anything along those lines. However, the folks on the team may measure progress differently.
Yeah.
They may be looking for learning.
Right.
They may be looking for purpose. There may be many qualitative factors that to them generate progress or define progress. Sometimes it can be, how well are we communicating with each other? How rapidly are we communicating with each other? There can be many different facets of this definition of progress. But where I often see it break down, and where certainly it broke down on occasions in Edison's world, was where those definitions were different. So we don't often think about that as we start a project or even as we get into it to refine and evolve those definitions of progress, and maybe not just accept someone else's definition right at the get-go.
Right, right. So
I just wanted to add something there.
Yeah.
I fully agree with that. And from my perspective, as I was looking at doing that social media change, that pivot point from a business-to-business sales perspective, it really wasn't so much about, hey, we should use more social media. Mm-hmm. It was trying to understand the context of how might this tool change what it is we're doing and reach people in a more efficient manner.
Right.
It's the same notion of not having to go down the same exact path.
Right, exactly. Go ahead, Sarah. You're going to say something?
It's a great example, because I think, you know, the task-oriented approach, which might be like the teamwork approach, if you will, is, okay, go get it done, send out the social media messages, let's do this over the next week, 2 weeks.
Right.
If you look at it collaboratively and as a collaboration, you say, you know, how can we most effectively engage this particular customer group? What are some of the ways that we could be most effective in reaching them? And that actually changes how you would work and what you're actually examining. So it might sound like a fine point, but really it shifts you from a task orientation to a learning orientation. And that's a big part of what differentiates the teamwork and collaboration components.
So, you know, I think in corporations, we feel there's a lot of restlessness these days. There are a lot of people who are leaving and starting their own companies because they feel stifled. They feel like the company is holding them back or can't allow them to be creative or innovative. You know, Sandra, I'm going to kind of direct this one at you. How can they hang on? I mean, what can they do, you know, to see the light within the corporation and you know, help the corporation grow?
Well, right. So the first thing, then, the biggest punchline here is to keep in mind that Albert Einstein came up with the most important equation, probably, arguably, that's ever been made while he was working at what he very much considered a dead-end job in a field that he had no intention in staying with. And I kid around about that. I think that there is a time for people to move on and go to different things, but I believe it's more organic than that. I believe that if you, inside of your own career, just stay after the things that are in your heart and the things that you're interested in, that eventually you're going to find your way into the right place. I'll tell a very brief story about myself, and it's sort of a sad one. I was
a sad story.
Yeah, it's a sad story, but I promise to be brief. Okay.
Okay. Got a tissue over there. Okay.
I was a sales manager in Minneapolis, and I was I really wanted to move into a new job. I wanted to do something around social media. I was all excited about this.
Yeah.
And we had just had a layoff, and then we had a reorganization. I found myself managing a whole bunch of people who used to be my peers, so it was getting kind of uncomfortable there. I went and talked to the regional vice president, and I said, look, I think I'm ready to go. I've been doing this job for 3 years. I got all these great ideas, and I'm ready to move on. And he said, I don't think so. I think you need to do this job a little bit better. And by better, what he meant was do it his way. Mm-hmm. And he gave me a litany of things that he was expecting to see from me and see from my team that would kind of be a litmus test of whether I was ready then to take on that next new thing.
Right.
Well, I walked out of that room and took on some of the worst advice I'd ever been given. I did just what he said. And when I did that, I actually became nothing. Mm-hmm. I was a disservice to myself. I was a disservice to the company. My numbers dropped like a rock, and I was actually asked to move on. I was mm-hmm. asked to move into a new role because I wasn't getting the job done. But the silver lining is, as I walked out the door and assessed what had happened, I asked myself, you know, really, why did this take place? And the reason was because I didn't remain true to myself. And I think that inside of a corporation, especially one even as large as the company I work for, that we can remain true to ourselves and that it can bring us to where we need to get to.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think that's why these two gentlemen made such a difference in the world. Nothing would tear them away from their goal, from their heart, from their soul, and what they were, you know, what they knew they could bring to the world. Sarah, you want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, well, one thought that comes to mind in thinking about Sandra's story is something that Edison really embodied and I think also focused on in his organizations, and that was being a catalyst. So today we think about being a leader, we think about being a manager, supervising other people. In fact, I think what Edison realized is that part of how collaboration is achieved is not so much through, okay, you're the assigned leader of Team XYZ, now go collaborate. It's what are the ways that you can serve as a catalyst? As an individual, how can you bring some of your own dreams and perspectives to what you're doing, but also to the broader realm of folks who are around you? Catalysts really transform the self and others. That's what I think differentiates them from just being, if you will, a raw leader. Leaders can also be transformative, but sometimes leaders, as in the example Sandra mentioned, is they're just trying to control.
Right.
So a catalyst is someone who actually has capability of generating leverage, of generating influence in unique ways. A moment ago, I talked about the microcultures at Microsoft, and I think this is really kind of how we can think about individuals within companies. You know, a lot of people do think about leaving. Wow, I have this great idea. I could do so much more. And as Sandra said, sometimes there is a time to move on. But another way to think about it is, wow, could I create like a little node within the company here? Mm-hmm. Could I kind of start a little microculture? Could I serve as a catalyst for something to happen around this idea or this notion or this problem, etc.? So I think it's another way of looking at this and kind of generating a new viewpoint on what to do when you're kind of contemplating these types of changes.
Desiree, can I just insert there that I absolutely wonder how much we as a nation spend on leadership training. Maybe this resonates with yeah. you too, Sarah. I'd love to hear what you have to say about this. But you know, what is leadership? Is leadership something you get from a title? Is it sort of a badge that gets pinned on your chest? Or is it something that is really just a behavior? And like you said, that catalyst behavior, it's the right thing at the right time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, there is a lot of money spent on leadership training in the U.S., and some of it I think that goes to a good end, and other parts of the training can, I think, sort of fall on deaf ears, if you will. I think part of what I'm seeing happening now in the realm of leadership training is something I refer to in phase three of Midnight Lunch, which is the notion of coherence, and that is shoulder-to-shoulder leadership. People don't always have to be, quote-unquote, entitled. They don't always have to be a vice president or a senior leadership, have a senior leadership role within an organization to be a shoulder-to-shoulder leader. A shoulder-to-shoulder leader is someone who is in your sphere, on your team, who can motivate you and inspire you in a unique way. So I think that we kind of miss the mark when we think about leadership training and leave that out.
Right. Again,
this is kind of gets back to the notion of being a catalyst and what will propel progress. So shoulder-to-shoulder leadership, I think, is something that we need to emphasize more in how we look at organizations and what they say about leadership.
So, you know, talking about shoulder-to-shoulder leadership, obviously Edison understood that and embraced it. Let's talk about the Midnight Lunch and what exactly that was and how that fits into that concept.
Well, a Midnight Lunch was a real activity that took place in Edison's laboratories. And this term Midnight Lunch actually was devised by Edison's employees. So what happened in a Midnight Lunch is periodically and without announcement, Edison would sometimes come back to the laboratory after hours, after he'd had dinner with his family. So on 7 o'clock, he'd come back to check on his experiments, and he would connect with the other folks who were also at the lab, some 10 to 12 people who might be monitoring their experiments as well. He would speak with them, share ideas with them. Everyone would kind of put heads together. They'd exchange notebooks, actually physically exchange them, and read about the experiments and hypotheses and insights that were being generated. So they'd do this for about 2 hours, and then Edison would order in food for everyone.
Two pizzas or one?
From a local restaurant, he'd get sandwiches and drinks and dessert.
Right.
They'd sit around for an hour and kind of let their hair down and just have social conversation, just casual personal conversation.
Right.
And it was during those interludes, if you will, that they kind of got to know each other as people and not just as employees. So this sense of collegiality was generated in these sessions. After an hour of telling stories and singing songs and doing all kinds of crazy things, like making music in the laboratory, they would go back to work until midnight. And so it was this unique combination of work time and social time that bonded people. It created this sort of invisible glue that was cloned throughout Edison's laboratories. So this is part of what I think we need to focus on today, is how can you create some of that invisible glue in a company? What are the approaches, what are the midnight lunch rituals, if you will, that you could create that will begin generating that kind of connection?
So, Sander, how are you taking that glue and using it with your own teams? Let's talk about that.
Yeah, something that really resonated with me when I read Sarah's book was about the notebooks. And I believe kind of the notebook of the of our age is the blog.
Right.
And just the ability to be putting that down. And there's two things about the blog that make it the notebook of the age. First of all, it's digital in format. But the second thing is it's public. And I believe that we're part of that information age that we're reaching has to do with absolute transparency and sharing. Because what I find that's interesting with both Einstein and with and Edison as well is that it wasn't like you had your one idea and had to hold on to it so closely. If you had one idea, if you had a catalyst and people who were going to be building off of that, there really was no end to the ideas that you can come up with. Now, certainly, inside of an industrial age, we have to be careful about secrets being shared and all that kind of thing. But I think less so today is that the case. And I believe just being a person who can create ideas, if you can get a team yourself, a company to that level, that honestly, there's nothing that's going to stop you or limit you.
Right, exactly. That's a great point. You know, I think that I come from the airline background, and there was a lot of top-down communication. It, you know, I'm not sure if it's still that way. It's been a while, but you know, you talk about pods, Sarah, and I was a flight attendant, and boy, you know, we would have to collaborate on that flight from point A to point B and make that happen for the customer.
Sure.
And so I saw innovation. Believe me, we would be very innovative, you know, especially if they ran out of meals when they used to serve them back then. But that was a great little laboratory for us, you know, on those flights working together. It's kind of an interesting, you know, aspect. But so what are you doing to coach your team around innovation then? You know, how are you teaching them? Because is collaboration learned, or is that something that's inherent?
Well, I think it's something that we can learn. I think the notion of working on something that's purposeful and meaningful is actually something that's hardwired into us. But the way we do that, the way we interact, the way we communicate, how we serve as a catalyst, I think those things can be learned. We think about the notion of collaboration as something that's modeled. Edison was very powerful in his ability to model what he desired around collaboration. He shared his notes. He had an open-door policy. He actually worked in the small rooms of the laboratory as well as the large machine shop areas of the lab. So he was connecting with people. He was sharing his thoughts. He was asking for input and working in a collaborative realm all the time. So I think this is something that we can think about in our own behaviors. How do we actually model collaboration? Are there ways that others could look to us as an example of what collaboration is? So when I think about, you know, training or mentoring a team around collaboration, I'm very careful to start and look at my own behavior and say, well, what am I sharing? You know, what am I putting out, you know, to others? What are the things that I'm offering? How do I serve as a catalyst? So I think that's one place to begin when we think about coaching. Another place to look is, what are the other experiences that a team has had around collaboration? And it may not be very large. It may be that, in fact, most of a given team's collaborative experience has been more task-oriented, you know, putting in your time. So I think it's then incumbent upon, you know, the catalyst within the group, if you will, someone who wants to generate that collegiality, is to start a program, to start a mode of engagement to bring the group together in this collegial framework and start to build some of those habits. That's, I think, some of the most effective advice that I might offer. It's fine to just send down that top-down communication,
right,
but it probably won't generate the type of collaborative activity that you're interested in.
Exactly.
Could I share something on this? Because this is something I'm really passionate about as well, is that, you know, from my perspective, all the things that I've been doing around social media and selling and business-to-business selling, I've been making it very public and very transparent. And people come to me and they say, well, why are you doing all this? You're giving away some sort of secret. You're giving away some sort of intellectual capital that maybe you could benefit from down the road as a consultant or otherwise. And I just basically say to them that is not the point here. The point here is bigger, and this is what Sarah was saying as well, is that we're all moving towards a higher purpose of having more efficiency in the marketplace. And I believe the things that I'm working on today, I think about them from the perspective of a customer as much as I do as from the perspective of a salesperson. Go ahead.
Talk about that. So do you collaborate with your customers, you know, using social media?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So that's a place where we can put what we like to call thought leadership from a content perspective. And that was a big part of what I did that was different here.
Right.
But it wasn't some sort of circus trick or trying to get people to do something. It was really just about this really radical notion of giving people what it is that they wanted. or what they were interested in.
Right.
And by giving people information that we held that we could just give to them that would said, hey, here are reasons or why you might want to buy this product or service,
yeah,
and did it in a way that wasn't like, and you need to buy it from us, but that there it is. Immediately, those people start thinking of us from a Synapse perspective as someone they want to collaborate with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. A business relationship is much collaboration as a relationship that's inside of a company.
Right. And it sounds like you took genuine interest in what the customer needed and what they were doing. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Sarah's saying with Edison,
yeah,
right? I mean,
right,
he was
that
taking
personal relationship.
Yeah, taking interest in his employees. He wasn't hoarding those notebooks and
right,
not showing it to anybody.
Exactly.
You know, I think this is a great point that you make, Sandra, and that is that, you know, the lines between, you know, customer and, you know, company, if you will, are blurring. And there's, you know, we talk about partnering, and we talk about, you know, how are we going to communicate with our customers or our markets, and sometimes we get very black and white about that. And I think part of what you're saying is really a lot of it does today boil down to offering information that might be different than what a company might yield or give. And again, this is not confidential information, but it creates a synthesis. I think this back and forth exchange is part of what yields a different kind of awareness and synthesis of what the data is saying, or you know, what insights can be generated from certain types of information. That has high value today. And so kind of generating these types of exchanges definitely goes beyond, I'll call it a revenue-bound structure. It isn't, well, how much am I getting paid for sharing this with my customer? It's, wow, what is the bigger picture? How can we really create something that is value-driving and bigger than just this immediate conversation?
So in this digital age, you know, of the internet, we have a lot of people working together and collaborating virtually, a lot of virtual teams. You know, we're seeing that more and more. We're seeing businesses that are actually made up of people who are virtually working in different cities. How do you talk about that? And do you think Edison, you know, and Einstein may have gone in that direction and worked virtually with somebody 3,000 miles away? How does that work? How do we make that work?
Well, I think this is one of the toughest challenges that organizations face today. Certainly, there are cost pressures that are pushing organizations to consider virtual teams more and more. And, of course, the technology pressures are very significant because we can instantaneously share ideas and information with others, you know, halfway around the world in seconds. So virtual teams do become something that is you know, a huge conversation. I think part of what is important in a virtual team is that they do have opportunity at some point in their project trajectory, if you will, to meet in person, that not everything be solely relegated to this virtual exchange.
Right.
This notion of collegiality that I talked a little bit about earlier, sharing the social conversation as well as the work conversation, that's the part that's extremely difficult in a virtual environment. So some of what I work with my clients on is how do you create some of those social exchanges within the virtual team? And there are ways of sharing virtually, like doing I'll call it a one-on-one or a two-on-two, where people pair up outside of the, if you will, meeting to share information and even be in an environment. Go to a unique environment and start, you know, talking about what's going on around you.
Right.
Or even doing like trivia contests and things like that that actually bring out some of the innate private knowledge that people have that you might never recognize or find in another setting. So the virtual teams need to be intentional. They need to be really focused on some of these social exchanges and need to be creative about how to generate those.
Yeah, for me, collegiality is really about trust. And I know that, for example, Einstein, he was very tight with many very important scientists of the day, Madame Curie being one. And they would get together out in Britain and have their kids run around and have wild parties and stay up all night and these kinds of things. But and I think that what they were building was that trust. A personal story of mine was I was working with a global company about 10, 15 years ago now. And there was a guy I was working with in Brazil named Ricardo. And so we had a sales meeting in Paris, France, and brought in everybody from the team from around the world. Well, one night after the training and the meetings was over, Ricardo and I decided we'd go see Paris. And we went down to the train station. There was a strike going on. And we ended up like having to get into a taxi cab, and neither of us spoke any French. And it was a wild, wild night. But the weird thing is Ricardo and I will still talk about that even now. And after that, I recall that it was just so much easier to work together, having just had that interaction one night.
Yeah. Isn't that funny how a shared personal experience makes all the difference? Mm-hmm. It's just great. That's a great story. So, Sander, where's AT&T going with innovation? Where do you see this going in the future with your company?
Well, first of all, I think there's a lot of leading by example that needs to go on. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of things that my company is doing as well, from a space perspective and a number of other wonderful things that we're doing to try to drive more collaboration. That's not really my job, so mm-hmm. I'm probably not the right person to talk about those things. But I can tell you that I think from a leadership by example, there's certainly the ears that I've gotten on the projects that I'm working on. And a lot of it, I think, boils down to just having this sense of mission and having the sense that, you know what, we need to work towards this bigger purpose and to really retool what we're doing. And because I think we've been doing it a long time. Mm-hmm. Again, that switch from the industrial age to the information age, we need to get there in order to remain relevant. I don't think by any means that we're in danger of ending up like RIM or Kodak, but that is definitely a cautionary tale that's out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And Sarah, what are you working on in your company, Power Patterns? What are you working on right now? Another book? What's going on with your work?
Well, actually, part of what I'm doing now is helping to train others on how to run a midnight lunch. I've actually been doing 5 and 6 hour sessions with executives that are a midnight lunch. So we bring 10 people together in a small setting and actually have work activity as well as social activity throughout this blended through this 5 and 6 hour session. And typically there's a theme around each midnight lunch. It's not a hard and fast theme, but it might be looking at a process. Mm-hmm. So the process might be, how do we do due diligence in our organization? Or how are we actually bringing Generation Y into our company in an effective way? So there's a theme to the midnight lunch, but from there, I'm actually guiding and training people on how to run a midnight lunch so that it creates this invisible glue that I was mentioning earlier and also yields some outcomes. Some sort of next steps, if you will, that people can then take in this collaborative structure and move forward with. So that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah,
and,
that sounds
really
like
looking
it.
Forward to building that out further.
That's great.
We should have one next time you're in town, Sarah.
Yeah, and actually that's a great segue, Sander, because she's going to be in town. You're speaking at Georgia Tech on September 25th and University of Georgia on the 26th of September. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm very excited and really honored to be coming down to Atlanta to speak at both universities. Georgia Tech, I think, is doing a lot of really forward-facing work around innovation. Certainly, there's so much going on in the classrooms there, training people around many of the technical questions that we're going to be tackling as a country in the next several years. So I believe that my speech is at 4:30 in the afternoon. There'll be more information on my website, which is powerpatterns.com, on the exact timing and location. I'm just getting some of those details right now from the university. But it's also going to be videotaped in part, so it'll be up online, and people can have a look at that. I'll also be sure to put that up on my website. And then on the 26th in the morning at I believe it's the Terry School of Business at University of Georgia. Mm-hmm. I'll be speaking at 8 o'clock and working to generate some conversation around collaboration. I believe there's a panel discussion that will follow my keynote, so that'll offer people an opportunity to ask questions and generate some input. So again, there should be some more information very shortly on that up on my website.
Wow, that's great. And that's a couple of good opportunities to learn more about what you do. And I'm glad they're videotaping that. That's really important. I love the web.
Helps capture some of those, key moments.
Absolutely. And so, Sander, let's close it out here.
Okay.
I think people look at you within AT&T and they go, wow, how did he do that? How did you have the guts to do that? Did you have somebody who just encouraged that in you, or did you just take the bull by the horns? Where can people... How do you make this happen, basically?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it culminated in many years of doing a lot of the wrong things.
Yeah.
And I've always been someone, I believe, who's been a thinker. And I've always thought about things, and I've always been tinkering with things in the back of my mind and writing things down. Mm-hmm. And two things really changed for me. Just that having a platform to blog from really helped. And I would recommend that to anybody who's out there who feels like they have got good ideas, because it's a way not only to just get validation, but to find out what other people are thinking. You quickly find yourself in a community of people who are thinking about the same things as you, and it's a great market for ideas.
Now, was that a personal blog, or was that within AT&T? How did that come about?
Yeah, it happened quite by accident, because one of the things I was trying to do with social media was create this content that I wanted my customer to see. But the problem with the content that we already had, it was much too salesy and too technical.
Right.
And I wanted to make it more business-focused and more approachable and more just plain old helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked the blog people if I could blog, as I mentioned, I think, earlier, and they were more than happy to allow me to do that.
Yeah.
And I quickly found myself into a blogosphere of other people, like-minded and not, exchanging ideas. And now I find myself posting on several different blogs and having many conversations all day long through Twitter and LinkedIn.
So where can we find you online?
The best places to find me is Sander Bean is my hashtag on my symbol on Twitter, and I'm also on LinkedIn. You can take a look at the groups that I belong to, and please join up and join in the conversation.
Yeah, that's great. That's really good. And your blog?
Yeah, okay. So there's also – I got to do some consolidation. I think Sarah can maybe help me out with this, or maybe you can, Desiree. But I blog for AT&T's Networking Exchange.
Okay.
And I also blog for Savvy Marketing New York City, which is you can find by searching Savvy Marketing New York City.
All right. That's great. Good stuff. Kevin, any final thoughts?
Nothing. They got me thinking about a lot of different stuff.
I did
want to talk to you guys how you guys feel about crowdfunding, because I feel like that a lot of the stuff you've been talking about really builds into that, and it's really an interest of mine.
I think crowdfunding is fantastic, and it's definitely something that if Edison were alive today, he would be involved with that type of work, and he would be just advocating the notion of generating funds through that type of activity. It's so powerful. I think it can really reach ideas that otherwise might not be funded through more traditional means. I think it's an outstanding resource.
I have to agree wholeheartedly. At AT&T, we have a crowdfunding, a crowdsourcing site where we vet new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I would say, though, is you need to take a lot of care when putting these things together to make sure that they're not just democratic, but that they have an element of what Sarah talks about in the book, that collaboration, and therefore getting to the very best idea that we can get to.
Right.
So that's one cautionary tale around that. But I absolutely
really good
agree.
Yeah.
And I don't see too much of that yet on the crowdfunding, but I think that, they need to move toward that.
Definitely. And they're going to come up with the best product that way or the best thing. So.
Yeah. So that's great.
Or tweaking it just a little bit,
Definitely.
Because you never know. Somebody 3,000 miles away and, in another country might have tried it and, had another idea and brought it to the table.
You can never have too many good ideas.
There'll be midnight, I predict, midnight lunches all over the world.
I love that. I'm waiting for the first digital midnight lunch everyone.
Sarah, you should sponsor that. That would be fun.
Buy your own pizza.
Midnight lunch. If we could only figure out how to eat the sandwich digitally, that would be
I don't think that's too far off.
I know, exactly. So, Sandra, are you speaking anywhere?
No, I have nothing on the docket. I know it's amazing. I'm sorry. I wish I did. But if anybody was interested in hearing me speak, I'm absolutely available.
Yeah, we would definitely let people know. We'll put your links in the show notes. Sarah, same thing. Find you on Twitter, and you know we'll put that in the show notes so everybody can find you. But thank you so much for such a great first show. This is going to really raise the bar for everybody else.
Definitely. It was such great information. I was over here and really enjoying myself, so I've got a lot to think about.
Sandra was taking tons of notes, Sarah.
I'll be writing to you.
I hope that I'll have a chance to see both of you when I come down to Atlanta, and Kevin, you as well. Would love to see you and also stay connected on LinkedIn and Twitter and all those good social media outlets.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Well, great. All right. Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
For being on the show, Sarah. Thank you, Sandra, for spending your time with us today.
You're welcome.
This is Desiree Scales. Thank you. This is Desiree Scales with High Velocity on Business Radio X. Everyone, have a great week.